On June 26, 2015, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that state bans on gay marriage were unconstitutional, making same-sex unions legal across the United States of America. But the road to that momentous decision was much longer than many know. In his new book, The Engagement, America's Quarter-Century Struggle Over Same-Sex Marriage, Sasha Eisenberg vividly guides us through same-sex marriage's unexpected path from the unimaginable to the inevitable. Sasha Eisenberg is the author of three previous books, including The Victory Lab, The Secret Science of Winning Campaigns. He is the Washington correspondent at Monocle and teaches in the political science department at UCLA. We welcome him to the roundtable this morning. Sasha, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you back on our program.
Thanks so much. Glad to be here.
It's wonderful to have you. This book is momentous and really just incredible to read this history. What drew you to the subject initially?
I was struck about 10 years ago that we were already starting to talk about this as the defining civil rights movement of my generation. And nobody had put together the whole story. And a lot of it, I'd been a political reporter. I'd covered politics. You know, I'd lived through the whole life of this as an issue in the country. I'd covered politics during the years that this was, you know, arguably the most divisive thing that we faced as a country. And I really had no idea where it started. I had no idea who the, you know, Rosa Parks of this movement was, or the Haymarket riots. And I had sort of grown up reading big books about the civil rights movement that the Journal had started writing in the late 1970s, and thought that the time was right for me to try to tackle something like that for my generation with a very similar sort of journalistic toolkit going at recent history.
So how hand in hand does the gay rights movement go with the same-sex marriage movement?
It takes a while for this to become sort of the defining cause of the gay rights movement. I write about how in the 1980s, folks within the gay and lesbian community, to the extent that they talked about this issue, and it was mostly lawyers and legal theorists who did, people were divided. There were particularly lesbian feminists who looked at marriage as this patriarchal institution that gay people, especially and women, should want nothing to do with. There wasn't a single gay rights organization in the United States that had endorsed marriage rights until the 1990s. What happens is that in 1993, the Hawaii Supreme Court becomes the first court on earth to rule that the fundamental right to marriage could extend to same-sex couples. And once conservatives on the mainland take stock of the momentousness of that ruling and what it might mean for other states and for the federal government, which leads to the Defense of Marriage Act, it's only then that gay activists decide, basically, our opponents now are about to fight tooth and nail to deny us this right. We have to be unified in fighting for it.
One of the things that you make very clear in this book is, and you can tell that really just by its length, but obviously in the words and in the story you tell, this is far from a ABCD path. This is very circuitous. It is very complex. It is a chaotic chain reaction. And, oh, by the way, it conflicts. And then there's just some good old-fashioned good luck that comes as well.
Yeah, I mean, this is a really interesting issue, because, first of all, both sides are on offense and defense simultaneously.
Right.
You know, people often compare this to the desegregation movement, racial desegregation movements, or women's suffrage. You know, there was nobody who was trying to extend Jim Crow in the 1950s to new states. There was nobody who was trying to roll back the right of women to vote in certain states in 1915. So one thing that just makes this interesting is it's playing out, both sides are sort of deciding where they want to go on offense, where they want to go on defense. It's playing out simultaneously in the legal realm, in courts, and in the political realm, in legislatures and through ballot measures in some states. And there's both a national and federal legal dynamic, and a lot of this is happening in state courts. And so, you know, it is a very, for a political conflict, it's a kind of very messy chessboard that both sides, once this really gets enjoined as a big national fight, there are a lot of little messy local fights that people have to calibrate. And yeah, there are some really you know, fortuitous things that happen. I think one of the what I think often we look back at these big civil rights breakthroughs and we're inclined to try to be, you know, because we sense that the ultimate justice of the result, we tend to think that it was inevitable. And part of why I wanted to show is that people sort of stumbled into this conflict at times by accident or with luck or serendipity. And it was by no means inevitable either that this was the thing that we were going to end up fighting about as a country or that it was going to be resolved, you know, when and how it did.
So let us go back a ways, because as you point out in the book, we know that we started to hear, obviously, as we think of this as, you know, in very recent terms of same-sex marriage, that throughout our history and since our beginning, that there have been this concept of marriage, of same-sex marriage, and that people had been had unions in one way or another. The idea of legal marriage, however, really starts, and you kind of put it on the map, is in the 1950s, where it is brought up as something that would be an important issue for gays and lesbians. And then we fast forward to the 1970s, where it's the first time someone actually tries, two young men actually try to get legally married in the state of Minnesota.
Yeah, and so, you know, there are in the wake of Stonewall, in the early 1970s, in the sort of first blossoming of gay rights activity around the country, there are a handful of couples that go into both state and federal courts and demand marriage rights. None of them are represented by major civil rights organizations in their marriage suits. Many of them are not being driven. They're being driven by activists who are sort of, you know, flushed with enthusiasm, but not with great legal strategy. And all of their suits fail. And by 1975, the advocate that the gay magazine called it the gay marriage boom of the early 1970s. But by 1975, it's done. And I think that's for a few reasons. One is the gay rights whole legal community becomes professionalized, becomes serious, and they are starting to win gains in other areas. You know, non-discrimination ordinances. You start to get some cities that in the early 1980s that recognize domestic partnerships, like for public employees. And so there are incremental gains that are gettable in places. And also, it's, you know, important to realize the extent to which AIDS was just a huge kind of distraction and diversion from a lot of other political activity. And so it's not until 1990 that these three couples get led by a local Honolulu activist to request marriage licenses at the Hawaii Department of Public Health, basically as a PR stunt, and they stumble into this unexpected victory before the Hawaii Supreme Court. And it's the first time after the long history that you recount that marriage is like a real legal possibility and can become a serious political objective. And two things happen. One, you start to have gay activists who say, hey, this is actually something that we could win. Nobody had really thought of it that way before. It was all very abstract. And also, you know, religious conservatives say, you know, we've been fighting gay rights activists on a whole lot of fronts. We now need to, we hadn't anticipated the idea that they were actually going to try to change the marriage laws. We now need to fight them on that front, too.
That is a fascinating moment because, as you write it in the book, it's 1990, three same-sex couples are looking to get married. A local gay activist, Bill Woods, is trying to spur this on to get the license, and of course, the state attorney general denies the license. What's interesting, and I'm hoping you can address this a little bit, as Woods was moving forward on this, no major LGBTQ organization was supporting what they were doing in that case. Why is that? Why? What? What led to that?
One issue is that you had this sort of ideological division within the community where primarily were just critical of marriage as an institution and thought, to the extent that there was a push for sort of LGBT family law, there were a lot of especially feminist lesbian attorneys who sort of said that the goal should be what they called multiple families, that the objective should be a spectrum in which the law treated not just married couples of both genders equally, but single parents or multi-member partnerships, or you know, what we would call polygamy or communal living. And so there was a real division over whether this was desirable. And then there was just a strategic tactical sense that this was a crazy reach for a movement that was just getting its footing with like really basic political demands. I mean, you have to realize in like the 1990s, one of the big fights in Congress is just to get the Justice Department to track in its hate crime statistics, to break out separate numbers for hate crimes attacks on gays and lesbians. They're pushing senators to come around on that issue. And it seems like going to politicians and saying, we want to change the 6,000-year-old institution of marriage would just be a crazy leap. And none of the gay groups, you know, I think that they wanted to be pragmatic in a way. And it just wasn't really an issue worth engaging on.
One of the points that you make in the book loudly and clearly, I think, is this idea that the Christian, what we think of as the religious right, looks at this and says, we have to keep marriage and we want to keep queer Americans away from this institution of marriage. And because they went to such lengths, ultimately, you say, and obviously this is not their intention, but activists then become to defend gay marriage because they have to concede and they concede the importance of that institution of marriage.
Yeah, so I think there's sort of two unintended consequences of the religious right sort of latching onto this issue in the mid-90s, and it starts with the Mormon Church, and then Catholics, and eventually sort of evangelical and fundamentalist Protestants. And they do two things. One is they, as you suggest, they unify the gay and lesbian community behind this quest for marriage rights. All of those sort of questions about pragmatism, the ideological divides, they just go away. And when the Defense of Marriage Act comes before Congress in 1996, you have some of the most biggest skeptics within the gay rights community saying that to give up or not fight for this thing would just be conceding turf to our rivals, and that would just disadvantage the whole movement. So, yeah, so they end up unifying the gay rights movement behind marriage as a priority. And two, they nationalize what had been a local issue. You know, marriage historically, with only very rare exceptions, has been a matter for states to determine. You know, the Supreme Court stepped in 1967 to strike down bans on interracial marriage. In the late 19th century, they said polygamy is illegal, but it's really unusual for this not to be something in which the federal government gives the states tremendous latitude. And religious conservatives decided that they were going to drag the federal government into basically this local fight in Hawaii with the Defense of Marriage Act, which said that the federal government didn't have to recognize those same-sex marriages and made clear that the other 49 states didn't have to either. And ultimately what they do, and it seems like it takes a while to realize how much of a strategic miscue this is, but ultimately it allows for this to be something that can be resolved at a national level. You know, the only reason this comes to the Supreme Court in 2013 is because the constitutionality of the Defense of Marriage Act is a federal matter for the Supreme Court to deal with. Otherwise, this could have been playing out in a very slow-moving way, state by state, without the possibility for, you know, 9 justices to settle this for the whole country.
Sasha Eisenberg is our guest this morning. The name of the book is The Engagement, America's Quarter Century Struggle Over Same-Sex Marriage. Two points I'd like to make. One is in regards to the I guess both of these have to do with money, but and money plays a large part of the story you tell here. But when it comes to religion getting involved, the Mormons, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, gets involved in California, and they put up like $20 million to support the Proposition 8, which ultimately would help ban gay marriage to the state constitution in 2008. That's a lot of money, and then later they're accused of money laundering. So I want you to address that. But then also, money really does come to the forefront here, because the movement itself realizes just how much money it can raise to become a pack, if you will, to bring in organizations to fight back such anti-marriage efforts.
Yeah, you know, so the Mormons are the first sort of institution to take seriously what's happening in Hawaii, and that begins in 1994, when they basically establish an alliance with the Catholic Archdiocese of Honolulu. And the Mormons are very savvy about how they do politics. They control tremendous resources, both in terms of manpower in some Western states and also just cash, but institutionally and individual giving by their members. But they're also very aware of their public perception. You know, and I think this goes back to the origins of Mormonism in the 19th century and still continuing to see themselves as an unpopular minority.
Right.
And so they understand that when they go into a state, they are ready to spend money, but they know that they shouldn't be the face of it. And so they basically set up a front group in Hawaii where the Catholics, in an effort to get the legislature to effectively override what the state Supreme Court has done, this partnership where the Catholics kind of agree to be the public face of this group, and the Mormons provide most of the money and expertise behind it. And that the Mormons drift away from this fight for several years. I think there are a few reasons for that. One, evangelicals move in and start to lead the marriage fight. And, you know, there are obviously longstanding doctrinal differences between the Mormons and evangelical Christians that do not make them good political partners. But also the 2002 Salt Lake City Olympics and initially the scandal around it make them really focus on their public image then. And then a version of the same thing happens when Mitt Romney's preparing to run for president in 2008. And so they, for the better part of a decade, drift away from this involvement in this very contentious issue. And they get pulled back in California. Mm. And it's in the summer of 2008, after same-sex marriage has been legalized in California, and Prop 8, which would render it illegal again, comes up for the ballot, that the Mormons decide that they're going to sort of go all in on this. And that takes two forms: telling their members to give generously to what becomes one of the most expensive campaigns in American history, but also one thing that is notable about Mormons is they have a lot of experience knocking on doors and having difficult conversations with strangers, and they become sort of this perfect field organization because they're like already structured in communities through stakes. And so they become not only the primary financial source, but the primary source of volunteer activity for the Prop 8 fight. And at the same time, as you mentioned, there is a cluster of gay donors, primarily white gay men, some of whom made their money through tech, some of whom have inherited it, but who are become overwhelmingly focused on marriage above other sort of LGBT issues. And by the mid-2000s, they have helped to not just put marriage at the top of the gay rights agenda, but to sort of professionalize the politics and build new institutions that can fight for both at the state level and eventually nationally. And, you know, New York State is a great example of what that looks like when it's put into action, because by the time this comes before the legislature in 2011, both the Assembly and the Senate, the economic foundation of this debate has shifted, and people know that if they're voting against same-sex marriage, that that is likely to redound in significant spending from gay donors towards their opponents the next time they're on the ballot.
So we are very quickly running out of time. We only have about 2 minutes left, and unfortunately, I'm left with a huge issue that I want to talk to you about. So, but I just want to mention it and address it quickly, which is, so as you mentioned, these white donors, there is very much a racial aspect to this. This is a very white movement in the beginning, and even after its passage, many of the letters in LGBTQ are left behind, really, because of the movement, and they're still paying that price today, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, one thing that's important to recognize is that marriage laws were not often impediment to trans people, or bisexuals for that matter, marrying the person that they loved. And so within that coalition, marriage restrictions were specifically a problem for gays and lesbians, and not always for bisexual transgender people. But as this got closer to the Supreme Court in 2015, there was a real question about how Anthony Kennedy, who ended up writing the majority opinion, and everybody expected would write this majority opinion because he had written prior gay rights opinions, would choose to write it. How broadly would he rule on what was wrong with these state bans? And ultimately, he chose to write about it as a marriage case, that this was about the unique institution of marriage and how people cannot be excluded from it, couples, because it disrespected both the couples and the children that they were raising. He chose not to write it as a civil rights opinion about discrimination against sexual minorities. If he had gone that direction, it could have offered significant legal protections, not just to transgender people, but to gays and lesbians who don't have them in a number of states, right, or under federal law. And that's one of the things that I think in retrospect, many LGBT activists sort of rue as the missed opportunity of this movement.
The book is fascinating and really, as I said, momentous, because it is so rich and sprawling. The Engagement, America's Quarter Century Struggle Over Same-Sex Marriage. It is out from Pantheon. Sasha Eisenberg, I thank you very much for joining us and taking the time out this morning. I greatly appreciate it.
Thanks, Joe. It's fun.
Be well. Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book, The Engagement, America's Quarter Century Struggle Over Same-Sex Marriage. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.